Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Footmarks podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And the title for today's episode of the Footmarks podcast is something that I originally came up with and then Jared updated it. It's Pink Pill Pulverizer. And that's because it's on Mitchell Stark's exploits with the pink ball. This, by the way, is being recorded in the direct aftermath of the Adelaide Test, in which Stark took career best figures of 648 in the first innings and took 8 wickets in total and set Australia up or inspired them to a series-leveling win. This is not the first time, Jared, that we've seen Stark destroy batting lineups with the pink pill, and he averages 18 with the pink ball in 13 day-night tests. 74 of his 369 test wickets at the point of this recording have come when the ball is pink. And that is quite sensationalism, I mean, or sensational. He's a different beast altogether, isn't he, when he's bowling with a pink ball?
He's completely, and we've never had a bowler who's had this. You know, we talk about Jimmy Anderson and clouds and Ashwin and home pitches, and it's like, that's normal, right? To be good in your home conditions is a completely normal thing. To be good with something that the rest of cricket doesn't... He's played more pink ball games than the rest of cricket has hosted, right? Yeah. Like, there's only eight others that have been hosted. And in them, he's been absolutely devastating. And then what's more interesting is that Hazelwood's been devastating and Cummins has been devastating, but they're really good all the time. And Stark just isn't. Like, there is, pardon the pun. No, I don't pardon the pun. I've done this on purpose. There's a stark difference between him and the red and the pink ball. Like, there's no other way you can look at it now. He is a very ordinary red ball bowler, right? And he's an absolutely destroyer of universes with the pink ball.
Yeah, and just to kind of double down on that, right? When you call him an ordinary red ball bowler, you're not exaggerating one bit. He's played 91 test matches and taken 369 wickets. His average is hovering around the 27.5 mark, right? When it comes to the red ball, that average jumps up to like close to 30. And with the pink ball, obviously, it's around 18. So it's a fair
statement. It's 32, isn't it, with the red ball, isn't it?
Is it? I checked it and it was 29.9.
Oh, okay. I might have got that wrong. You might be right. Yeah.
But I think it's very, very fair to make that statement that he's been fairly average or just above replacement level in, you know, red ball cricket and test cricket when it's played with red ball. And there are a few peaks mid-career, which if you take out, it becomes even more ordinary. So the pink ball has contributed heaps to his record.
Yeah, you're right. 29.9. Sorry, for some reason I thought it was even more than that. Look, you look at the last few years and he has been averaging, he's got some very high averaging years in the last couple of years. So
yeah. So the last time he averaged under 26 in a calendar year of test cricket was 2020. So it's been a hot minute.
Yeah. So he has two good years there.
And this is an era, like this is the pace playing pandemic, right?
That's
bowlers are taking wickets left, right and center.
And it is interesting that him, Sam Curran and Trent Bolt all kind of took a step back during the place playing pandemic and the right armers took over. There is something, because I think I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Trent Bolt was one of the few bowlers in the world whose record didn't get boosted by the place playing pandemic as well, right? So there's a couple there. Okay, so he's not taking wickets when everyone else is taking wickets. And the thing that has kept him in the side has been the pink ball games in that time. Yeah. Like if you take the pink ball games out over the last couple of years, he doesn't really pop at all as a test bowler. And I don't want to say that you would use him as a specialist at the moment, right? But you look at Scott Boland's bowling and let's say Jai Richardson is fit, right? I think it's hard to, other than the fact he's left arm, I think it's very hard to make a case for him being automatically a better bowler than them, that the stats don't really suggest that. Do you know what I mean? Like it's the pink ball is what makes his stats look really good. So if you look at where I was here, so you said 2020, he averages 20, all right? So in 2021 with the red ball, he averaged 44, right?
Wow.
In 2022, he averaged 31.69. In 2023, he averaged 29.63. And so far in 5 tests this year, he's averaged 36.71 with a red ball. Right? Scott Boland was averaging 12. Couldn't get in the side. Right?
Yep.
And I get it. He's a different bowler. And also, there's a bit of overlap with Boland and Hazelwood, which probably makes him feel a little bit awkward. They want the left arm angle. They want the bounces, perhaps, and everything else.
They want the height.
But those are not... Yeah, the height. Those are not the figures of a top-class test bowler. And then you put a pink ball in his hand, and it's like, get out the way. He's going to take all the wickets.
Yeah, it's like there's no two ways about it that the pink ball has definitely elevated his overall numbers, and it's probably kept him in Australia's test side, which is why I want to talk about match factor. It's something that we've worked a lot with over the last 6 months or so at Good Areas, and you kind of did a split on Stark's match factor when it comes to the red ball, the pink ball, and the white ball, specifically in ODI cricket, because he's thought of as one of the greatest ever bowlers to bowl in ODIs, right? So red ball match factor is close to one. So he's, like I said earlier, just above replacement level, and it's nothing special over there. We think of him as a great ODI bowler, and I mean, the numbers suggest so as well. He's 34% better than all the seamers who feature in the same games that Stark plays in ODI cricket. But when it comes to the pink ball, these numbers get a bit ridiculous. The match factor is 1.74, which means he's 74% better than the rest of the seamers who feature in the same pink ball tests that Stark plays. That's an unreal match factor. You know, I mean, I don't know how to make sense of it. And it also tells you that, you know, there are certain elements within the pink ball that make it more dangerous. But Stark is doing something extra special over here because he's just three quarters better than everyone else.
So when you say he's 34% better than everyone else, that I think anything over 25% is just almost automatically great, right?
Yeah.
Like there's no pissing about. Because I remember, you know, guys like, and some of this is average, of course, and we would also have to factor in econ and everything else.
But yes,
my memory of Garner and McGrath, when someone did a similar thing, was around the same mark of 30%, 32%, 34%, right? That was just average again.
Yeah.
So we know that Stark is on that level as one of the greatest 50 over bowlers of all time. And we've seen him do it in bunches of World Cups. No one has any issues with that.
Hmm.
And he's nowhere near the level he is with the pink ball.
Yeah.
Right? It's not even close. And he's bowling in those games with Cummins and Hazelwood at the other end.
Hmm.
Right? And Joe Richardson, didn't Joe Richardson take a bunch of wickets in one game? Scotty Boland's taken a bunch of wickets in some of these games. You know, Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad have played in some of these games. Like, it's not as if he's going up against, you know, Bangladesh's seam bowlers from 2012 here. Like, this is a legitimate bowling lineup, and he is completely dominating them. And also, it would be one thing if, I don't know, let's say the pink ball was, like, really high scoring. Right.
Yeah.
And I know instead of averaging 30, 32, it was averaging like 35 or 38. Right. Mm. If you had that and then you had what Stark is doing at the moment, you'd be thinking, well, okay, like everyone else is struggling with it a little bit. And so he's just doing really, really well. And so it's making his numbers look better. The pink ball isn't averaging over 30. Even in Adelaide, I think it averages like 28 or 29. Like, and that's one of the high grounds. Mm. So it tells you just how much better he's doing than everyone else, and everyone else is also doing really well. Like, it's bizarre, man.
It is. It's flat out batshit crazy. And I mean, you know, let's kind of talk about the nature of the ball over here a bit, right? You and I were speaking about this on Good Areas Live, and you mentioned how the extra lacquer on the pink ball. Oh, there it is. It's right in front of us, right? The magenta hot rock. Anyway, so the extra lacquer allows bowlers to... All right, Afridi, eat that ball. For all of our audio listeners, Jared was just about to take a bite off the pink ball. But yeah, that extra lacquer allows the ball to swing for longer, which definitely benefits Stark. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that it's got a shinier surface. So under lights, it's difficult to decipher which delivery Stark is bowling. So it's harder to read out of his hand. And then also the white ball, like when it's brand new, Stark gets to really make it talk, right? There's a lot of purchase for him, but the white ball goes softer quicker, whereas the pink ball stays harder for longer. So how much of a contributing factor is all of this, like the nature of the ball and its composition and the materials combined, to Stark's success?
So I do have a white ball here, don't I? So I will quickly go over and get one.
Okay, he's gone to collect that white ball, although I do think it's a plastic white ball, but it'll work, I feel.
No, I've got the real one. This is okay. This was signed by Andrew Simons. There you go.
All right. Right. Rest in peace.
You can see this is a beaten up crap ball, right? But you can see how clear the seam is on this ball.
Yep.
Compared to the pink one.
Hmm.
Right? The black, or the gray in this case, or the dirty, whatever it is, still stands out in a way that the black does not stand out on the pink ball. Now, why this matters for Stark is when he bowls with a red ball, the seam is quite easy to see for most batters, right?
Yeah.
So they can see when he's holding it for, well, actually he'd be holding it that way. If he's holding it to swing the ball back in, right? Or if he's holding it for three quarter seam, right? They could see that straight away. They'll have no issues being able to see that. Which means that for every single ball, they're like, okay, he's trying to go straight here and he's trying to swing this one back. Doesn't mean that those things will happen, of course, because we know that with the three-quarter seam, it might do weird things. And sometimes he tries to swing it and it still goes straight. But the batter gets an idea. When they face him in these games, they can't tell if he's holding it for swing or if he's holding it for three-quarter. So they're not getting those cues. So in a way, in pink ball games, Mitchell Stark turns into a wobble ball bowler, right? And so he gets an advantage in those games that he doesn't get in anything else. So that's the start, right? I think that's important. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that I don't have a brand new white ball here, but I've got brand new pink balls and I've held brand new white balls. Brand new white balls, if you touch them, they get stuck in your hand in a way that a pink ball and a red ball will not. And that is because the white ball is painted, right? Uh-huh. And these balls are dyed. And so the lacquer goes onto them a little bit differently. And the lacquer comes off the white ball. You can see this. This ball is just, there's nothing left of this ball, really, of like any kind of shine or anything. And this is probably 25 overs old, this ball, right? It's not a particularly old ball. Whereas if this was a red ball, there would still be an element of some shine and some grip on it. So the white ball will swing really violently, as we all know.
Yep.
For about three or four overs, right? Because this is a combination between the pink and the red ball, it swings for longer. And because there's a lot of lacquer on it, because they are still a little bit softer than the red ball, it's harder and it's swinging for longer, which means that you can, if you're a swing bowler, and even if you're an imperfect swing bowler, you're still going to be moving the ball around quite a bit. And then the third thing is...
Complete your thought.
No, and then the third bit is that this ball is just going to be harder than a white ball.
Yeah.
Right. So what this white ball here, if I got you to pick this ball up compared to any red ball I have in the house, you would instantly be like, I get what you mean. It just doesn't quite feel like it's as hard as an old red ball will. Right.
Yeah.
The pink balls are really, really hard. Right. They are very, very hard. And so when the white ball, he gets all that assistance early on with the swing, right? But he doesn't get the secondary assistance. So we know he's good with swing. What's the other thing he's good with? Bounce.
Yep.
Right? The pink ball bounces, right? And so I think those three things come together to make him a far better bowler with the pink ball in Adelaide. Than the red ball, because he doesn't get those advantages with the white ball or the red ball. The red ball takes away a lot of his advantages. To swing a red ball, your wrist has to be almost perfect.
Yeah.
To swing a white ball or a pink ball, not really as much, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you also mentioned how Stark has had his struggles with his wrist, right? And when he was trying to learn the wobble ball that nearly killed his swing. And if you think about Mitch Stark, even left-arm seamers, you know, he's not a conventional swing bowler like someone like Jaminder Wass or even Zaheer Khan, you know, that's another name. But he swings it a mile with the pink ball. So it's clearly that extra lacquer which is aiding him in those day-night test matches and the hardness of the delivery. But it's interesting how he's the first name that comes to mind when you mention pink ball tests or day-night tests. And other bowlers are bowling in these games too, Jared, right? Like, they aren't reaping those rewards that Stark is.
No, and I think everything I just said is kind of a little bit more unique to him. So Josh Hazlewood is really good with the pink ball, but he's also really good with the red ball, but he's doing almost the same thing.
Yeah.
He's just coming in and bowling wobble balls, right? And the only difference is occasionally he gets the ball at night and they're a little bit harder to see because you don't see the ball as well at night as you do in the daytime. That's the only difference for Josh Hazlewood. And maybe the lacquer stays on the ball a little bit longer and keeps it a little bit harder. So he's a little bit taller, so he gets a little bit more edges, right? So he's got two micro advantages there.
Yeah.
Mitchell Stark has the nighttime advantage, right? But he has three major advantages. So he goes from this level to here, whereas Hazlewood probably goes from here to here, right?
Yeah.
So there isn't as much of a jump. And that's what I'm saying. If you're facing Pat Cummins, outside of the few times when he's trying to swing the ball, it is very rare that you are facing Pat Cummins and you are like, oh, I can see he's trying to seam this in or seam this away, because everything's a wobble ball. So you're constantly playing him like that. If you're playing Mitchell Stark, you're constantly playing him in one way. And you're thinking, we'll see off the first two overs of swing, then we'll be fine. No. He was swinging it in like his third spell in that other game, right?
Absolutely.
Like, when was the last time we've ever seen him swing a red ball more than like for two or three overs? Like it just maybe in England occasionally or New Zealand. It's really rare, right?
And you know what's more ridiculous over here?
Those people swing differently. Cricket media used to be pretty simple. Find your favourite newspaper, head to Cricket Info, and maybe a blog you'd like. Now just finding the best stories and writing is a huge challenge. You already have a job. You just want to read about cricket. Well, that is what the best of cricket is currently doing. They go out daily to find the newest cricket coverage and the best stories from any publication in the world. And when they can't discover what they want, they also hire some of the best writers to produce their own great stories. You can get the best of cricket via their website or on WhatsApp. They find cricket's best stories and give them to you every day.
What's more ridiculous here, in my view, is that we've spoken a lot about how these surfaces are a bit grassier in Australia now and they've gotten tougher to bat on, and the Kookaburra has a reinforced seam as well. And Perth was a surface where a tall dude like Stark was supposed to be lethal, but we don't see that jump from him in red ball cricket, right? It's just the pink ball where you see that massive gulf between, okay, you're ordinary and now you're extraordinary. Whereas all bowlers have benefited with the red ball as well as in recent years. And Stark doesn't like seem to be benefiting over there. So that's just an interesting one.
Yeah, I just think when you go through all the things that the pink ball gives him, he just doesn't get a lot of those advantages with red ball. I would say over the last couple of years, he can still swing the ball in those first two overs. So he still has the Rory Burns Jaiswal ball within him, right? I think at times he struggled with that, especially with the white ball. He went through a period where he didn't, but I don't think it ever completely went away. But if you look at him, I think he was at his best, especially when he's not bowling with a pink ball, is probably bowling back of a length just outside off stump and getting that extra bounce and nick through.
Yeah.
That is his like backup mode though, right? That's the mode he goes through when nothing else is working. Even when he does that with the pink ball, he's still in a better position to be able to do that because you can't see the wobble ball coming, right? You can't see, you're still like, he might be swinging this back in. Right? Yeah. And if you look at the two shots that Kohli and Rahul played off him, they were both unsure if the ball was coming back in or not off a back of a length ball. If
they couldn't commit with a red entirely, ball, you know, to those shots.
If you face him with a red ball, you are never worried about that, right? Once, if it's not the first over or the third over, you're like, he ain't going to swing this back. I'm not going to have to worry about this, right? He becomes an angle bowler at that point.
Yeah,
and the pink bowler keeps you guessing.
Yeah, we understand that he is lethal with the pink ball, and we've discussed many different factors over here that kind of make that a reality. But here's an anomaly within all of this. The Adelaide Oval Strip has historically been a batting paradise, right? We know that. And it's even limited overs cricket, you kind of want to score a lot of runs over there. And amongst venues that have hosted day-night tests, it has the highest batting average. It's not a lot. It's still slightly under 30.
Yeah.
But for all the other grounds combined, that batting average is even lower. Stark, however, averages about 16 or a bit less than 16 with the pink ball in Adelaide and over 21 elsewhere. And, you know, everyone else is doing the opposite. They're going for more runs in Adelaide and they're bowling better in other grounds. And yet Stark is still slightly better than all of those bowlers in other grounds as well. You know, he's averaging around 21. So how do you even explain all of this?
Yeah, I mean, you can't, but yeah, I think you're right. I think the other bowlers are averaging around 28, 29 in Adelaide. And as you said, he averages 16.
Yeah.
And then they come down to average about 23 everywhere else. And he comes up to average about 21 everywhere else, right?
Yep.
The only thing, I think Varun found this, which was that the ball in Adelaide, the pink ball bounces a little bit more for him, and, which is weird because he's played a test match in Perth with the pink ball. He's played at the Gabba with the pink ball. Like these are not wickets that don't bounce, but for whatever reason, and if you think about Stark, that is the secondary major skill, right? The first one is he's very fast at the top, and then the secondary major skill is that back of a length, as I said, you know, almost defensive. He's not a defensive bowler because he can't keep the ball on the line of length long enough. But, you know, almost a defensive option for him is whacking it in, angling it across to a right-hander or angling it back into the left-hander and cramping him up. Maybe in Adelaide, for whatever reason, he's just getting something that helps him and gets that little bit of extra bounce. But why he's getting that extra bounce there and not in those other places, I can't tell you. That I don't know. But Adelaide has changed as a wicket. But I wouldn't say that even in that last test, it was particularly, you know, it didn't bounce as much as Perth Stadium, did it? And yet suddenly, you know, he seemed to keep that in. So I cannot explain why he's so much better in that. Like, he's definitely better with the pink ball everywhere. That bit we follow. But why he is specifically so much better in Adelaide, that might just be a weird thing. But I love the idea that he'll be like 45 and just coming back to play in Adelaide every year and just everyone just going, oh, not again.
I mean, if I was Cricket Australia, I would schedule 2 pink ball tests a year instead of 1 and, you know, just play Mitchell Starc for as long as he can possibly bowl in those 2 test matches. And he's got this.
Honestly, yeah. I think in the future they will. I think Perth, Melbourne and Sydney might not do day-night games. For Perth because the game's too late.
Yeah.
Melbourne and Sydney because it's holidays and people can go and watch anyway. I think all the other test venues will probably end up being day-night in the future.
We've had day-night tests at the Gabba, so there's no reason why we won't see
and
support.
Hobart as well.
True.
And Hobart's not even a good place to do day-night test matches, and they still did one there. Like, I've been to Hobart in the middle of summer and frozen my nipples off, my man. But I think it makes a lot more sense. If that's the case, you keep Mitchell Starc could play at home for a very long time.
I mean, they might have that new ground at Hobart, right? Which might replace the Bellerive Oval. I know it hasn't been kind of sanctioned off.
It ain't going to be warmer, mate. They're not putting it in a warmer part of Hobart. I can promise you that.
If they have an overhead roof, then maybe they have some air conditioning as well. Who's to say, right?
Not air conditioning, heating. Heating.
Yeah, same.
It's Hobart. Heating.
Central heating.
I will say this. Hobart's actually the best place to be during the Australian summer because it's quite usually a nice temperature. But just at night, sometimes when it gets dark and suddenly the breeze comes in from the Arctic or I don't know, Tasmania, but it gets freaking cold and you're just like, I just had shorts and a t-shirt on. What's happened here?
Sounds a lot like Canada to me, honestly. But anyway, Starc, we all know, has had a penchant of taking new ball wickets. It is a part of his legacy. More so perhaps because of white ball cricket, because we have a lasting image of him cleaning up Brendan McCullum in the 2015 World Cup final, right? And then we've seen that same movie play out tons of times, right? But interestingly enough, he's struck with the or on the first ball of a test match like thrice, which is also a record. And only Jimmy Anderson has taken more first over wickets than Starc in test cricket. And Jimmy like played, what, 180 odd test matches, right? So Starc has played half of those.
I think that's, by the way, I think that's in our database because I don't know how far you can go back. So that's probably since 2000. I'm not saying there is another. I mean, I don't know how many McGrath took. You'd have to go through. Yeah. But someone like McGrath or Courtney Walsh usually built a second over, didn't he? So McGrath or Ambrose might be 2 other guys that might also be up on that level. But we don't have the numbers.
Well, let's talk about the bowlers who bowled in Starc's era, right? So over there, he's second only to Jimmy and he's played a lot less than Jimmy. And we all have, or we've spoken about how his average tends to increase as the game progresses because the ball gets softer, unless it's a pink ball, right? So when it comes to defining Mitch Starc's legacy, especially in test cricket, because ODI is a separate ball game, just park that on the side, right? Where does he like rank amongst the greatest Australian bowlers? Because by average, for all seamers who have taken 200 plus test wickets for Australia, he is 7th. He's behind Jason Gillespie and ahead of Geoff Thompson. And if you take the pink ball out, his average would probably be, I don't know, 30 or even north of 30. Because if you replace those 13 pink ball tests with red ball ones, who's to say he would have done remotely as close to what he has managed right now? So I don't know. Where do you place the pink ball in his legacy? Where do you place the new ball in his legacy? First over wickets and all of that stuff. Who is Mitch Starc? What's his identity in test cricket?
I think it's a fascinating question because that group of those 4 young seamers who came through at the same time. And sadly, we never got to see the best of James Pattinson. If you've ever get a chance to find some of the highlights, like James Pattinson's best ball was probably better than anyone else other than maybe the Starc new ball. Pattinson was incredible. But sadly, we never got to see him at full strength in test cricket, really. And then when Australia was quite excited as a cricket nation when the other 3 finally could play. Like, it was a big deal when all 3 of them played. I don't think there were many matches where we had Hazelwood, Pattinson and Starc even, right? Like someone was always injured. Someone was always out and Cummins was out for like, what, 6 years.
Yeah. And so even Pattinson was out for so long in the middle, right? Like, and then he had some other issues.
So you never really got that. And that young group, we all knew about them when they were teenagers. Like Pattinson's brother had played test cricket, you know,
for
Mitchell Starc. Yeah, for England, weirdly. He was hyped up massively. Cummins was huge. And Hazelwood would have been almost as big if it wasn't for the fact that Cummins was there. And already Starc had already, I think he's a little bit older than the other guys.
Just slightly. I think Starc is nearly 35. The Hoff is around 33, and Cummins is actually younger than these guys. He's in and around that 31 area.
Yeah, and so Stark was the one we sort of saw first, and also Stark was getting compared to as the next Mitchell Johnson almost straight away. Different kind of bowler, but left-arm bowler bowling quick, right? Like, what are you going to do? And so there was lots of hype about them, but as a unit. And so they've always, and then their careers all overlap, and they've all got what? Well, they've all got over 200 test wickets, yeah, right?
250 even. I think both Hazelwood and Cummins now have over 250 wickets now.
And you throw Lyon in. And so there's a quartet element of them, right? Cummins' legacy is fine. You know, he's won World Cups. He's beaten right-wing media. he's done everything he's had to do, right? And being exceptional. Even if he ends up for the next couple of years averaging 25 rather than 21, I think his legacy is fine. Hazelwood has now got to a point where everyone in the world except for my father thinks he's a good bowler, right? Like, and is, you know, and is very, very well accepted that he's a top level bowler. So both of them have had their moments, and Lyon, as the off spinner who shouldn't have existed in the first place, has had his moment. Yeah. Stark is kind of weird because his red ball stats are pretty much Peter Siddle.
Yeah.
So Peter Siddle, 221 wickets at 30.66.
Basically, right? Yeah, that's very, very identical. Stark has what gotten? If you remove 74 from 369, you end with 290 odd wickets in what, 78 test matches at the time of this recording. And that's very comparable to Peter Siddle.
Merv Hughes, what's he got? 53 matches, 212 wickets at 28.38. Right. So even slightly better than Stark's Red Bull one. Neither of them are legends or even thought about as top level bowlers. Now, the big difference I would say is that Stark is at one stage was one of the best T20 bowlers in the world. He was obviously one of the best ODI bowlers in history.
Yes.
And he's a test bowler. So you've got all that. But the other thing is, how do you factor in? Like, would Merv Hughes or Peter Siddle suddenly have turned into superhuman with a pink ball? Probably not.
Hmm.
Right?
I suppose so.
So I don't know how to really tell you what Stark's legacy with the red ball is, because his legacy with the red ball is muddled with this pink ball. But if you, and you said before, that his average would have gone up. Maybe let's say it stays the same and it's 29.9. He's not Jeff Thompson, right?
Yeah.
And he's not as charismatic as Merv Hughes, right? So where would he have been remembered? He might not have been remembered all that much. Would he have been, I don't know. I'm trying to pull out like older players like Jeff Lawson.
I mean, Jared, you're saying that he would have maintained the same average. Who's to say Stark would even be in the team, right, if the pink ball never came about?
Exactly. And so you've got, so Jeff Lawson was a really good bowler. He takes 180 wickets at 30.5. I can't remember what McKenzie's record is, but I think it's probably roughly the same. There's a lot of
McDermott?
Australian bowlers.
Because people do remember McDermott. Right.
So I think Craig McDermott is, that was actually the next one I was going to bring up, because I think Craig McDermott is the better one to mention here, because Craig McDermott is someone who, to be fair, won World Cup as well.
Yeah.
He took 291 wickets at 28.6. No one talks about him anymore. And he was at one stage probably, if not the fastest bowler in the world, then one of the fastest bowlers in the world. He was genuinely exciting in the mid-80s. Came back in the 90s as a sort of like prototype Alan Donald type bowler, I would say. Not quite as good as or as accurate as Alan Donald, but suddenly he was a little bit more skillful. He was still really fast. You know, he's a big physical guy coming through the crease. You're the first person to say Craig McDermott's name out loud, right, in 7 weeks. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
I do.
World Cup winner. World Cup winner, 291 test wickets, better than 30, and no one mentions him anymore. And so I think Stark's a little bit more exciting than Craig McDermott. Not that much more, all right? But I do think he was a little bit better. Craig McDermott was a really good ODI bowler, whereas Stark is a great ODI bowler. There is a big distinction there. But there is an element there of when you start to realize where he fits in, it is a little bit more confusing, right? Because there isn't a natural thing. So are we going to be spending the rest of our life telling our grandkids that you have to understand with the pink ball, he was the best? They kept giving him the red one. And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the go. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your two times ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win.
Trophies also matter in this. He's won two ODI World Cups. He's won the T20 World Cup, right? IPL. Even though he wasn't really good in the T20 World Cup, if you remember. And even the IPL, right, just recently, turned up in the knockout stages or the playoffs. And before that, he was absolute garbage. But I feel like also having the World Test Championship under his belt, his legacy is a lot to do with trophies. And maybe that pink ball will never even be an asterisk because people aren't going to break those test numbers down like we do. People are just going to look at them holistically and they're going to be like, okay, 27 and a half, that's better than Jeff Thompson, right? That's what they're going to see.
And I think when it comes down to it, he still has to take those wickets. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of someone else. Like, so Brett Lee, we did Match Factor with him and Brett Lee.
Yeah.
And Brett Lee's match factor is better than Mitchell Starc.
Because he bowled in a very challenging era for bowlers, right? On flat decks. Right.
Also, he had very good bowlers in his side, although Starc, to be fair. But either way, but when it comes down to it, like Brett Lee's legacy is more a broad legacy than a test legacy, right? It is the limited overs is part of his legacy, right? Mm. And making runs in a World Cup game against New Zealand. It was New Zealand one. I think makes runs.
Bowling at 160 clicks is also a part of his legacy.
But that's what I mean. Like, so his legacy is very few people talk about Brett Lee, the test bowler, is my point.
That's
so
true.
I wonder if that's what happens with Starc. It just becomes a bit of a blur. And it's like, I'm not comparing him to Wasim Akram, but a little bit like Wasim Akram. It's very rare we talk about Wasim Akram in each individual format in the way that we do about Glenn McGrath.
Yeah.
Right. Dale Steyn's another one, right? Dale Steyn's limited overs career was really, really good, but Dale Steyn is test cricket with a backup, right? And so with Mitchell Starc, I think it's more going to be that Brett Lee was a Macram thing, right? Mm. Where you just go, no, overall, you have to understand he was this. How good was he in test cricket? He was okay. He was pretty good, you know, but realistically, as an overall bowler, he was this.
I mean, I think people who have kind of watched test cricket regularly in the last decade will always remember what a phenom Mitch Starc was and is and continues to be with the pink ball, right? I feel like when you talk of his test legacy, that has to be mentioned, you know, in future generations. People need to know that, yes, his numbers look acceptable because he was an absolute demon when it came to bowling with the pink ball.
Yeah, and also, he's got, like, I think because we talked about before that wicket at the front, and I know some of that is white ball cricket, but a lot of it is red ball cricket because he's taken a lot of wickets in the first over. Hmm. There is a genuine box office thing with it. Like, I don't want to slag off all the other bowlers in world cricket, but we don't have many wayward bowlers anymore.
Yeah.
Right? We don't have many Mark Woods and Mitchell Starks left, right? Hmm. I still got high hopes for Marco Jansen to never get it right because I enjoy someone who can't always put it where he needs to. Maybe Gerald Kotsia is another one. Nahid Rana, obviously from Bangladesh. Very high hopes for him never being accurate, right? Hmm. But realistically, most bowlers now are accurate. Yep. There's a box office nature to Mitchell Starc. And I remember talking to Ed Cowan about this once. So, like, who's harder to face in the nets? Hmm. And this was towards the end of Mitchell Johnson's career, of course. I said, is it Mitchell Johnson or Mitchell Starc? And he said, Mitchell Starc. And he said, because Mitchell Johnson kind of knows where he's bowling the ball. Hmm. And Mitchell Starc doesn't. Now, remember, Starc was young at that point and things have changed. But there's still an element of sometimes you'll watch Mitchell Starc come in and he'll bowl a ball and he'll walk back to his mark and you see him and he said, go, that was not what I was trying to bowl. You could see it in his face of like, yeah, that wasn't supposed to be a wide half volley. Why was that a wide half volley, right? There is a element of unpredictability that we are losing through this whole Jasprit Bumrah, Rabada, Cummins, you know, Atkinson, right? Yeah. You know, all these guys are coming through. They're just so predictable. And when you get a Shemar Joseph or a Mitchell Starc, it's like, I don't know what he's going to do next. This could be fun. It could be terrible.
I suppose.
There's an experience element to it that I think we are lacking as bowlers get more accurate.
He's definitely a more visceral sort of bowler that you really enjoy watching in the flesh, right? If he's bowling, you're like, all right, Starkey, let's do something over here. And overall, just the whole experience of that bowling action and the thunderous pace, even at 30, nearly 35 years old, he's regularly clocking 140 plus, right? So he is definitely express if you look at his career throughout. But I feel like overall, if I look at him, he's always been cinema or theater. With the white ball, he's box office because, you know, all of his exploits and all of his success. And with the pink ball, maybe he's like Oscar worthy. I think that's how you'd put it. That's the only way I can think of describing it. But yeah, it's a great legacy to have nonetheless, even if it's got a few caveats in it.
Look, he came into a team with two better bowlers in it than him.
Yeah.
We still talk about him more than we talk about Hazelwood.
That's right? True. Like, he was the most expensive IPL auction buy not too long ago.
And he was, you know, as a white ball bowler, wasn't even particularly in form. Like, there is something about Mitchell Starc that I find him endlessly interesting. And, you know, just to finish off, I know it's not exactly, but you mentioned it before, the loudest I've ever heard the MCG in my life, right? And I've been there for AFL Grand Finals and Anzac Days and Boxing Days and all these things. The loudest I ever heard it in my life was when he took Brendan McCullum, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to say that Hazelwood or Cummins or, you know, or Nathan Coulter-Niles couldn't have, you know, produced that.
The Behrendorfs of the world.
Yeah, but there was something, there's something about a big fast bowler coming into a guy who was going to whack him for six every ball, who was just going to aim for the stumps, right? And, you know, and remember, McCullum felt invincible in that period.
Yes.
And it's still the loudest thing I've ever heard in the MCG. Maybe one day I'll go back and there'll be something that will beat it. But Mitchell Starc, if he does nothing else, has done that. And I think his career, we can pick apart it because it's so interesting, but he is essentially a person of those moments.
Yeah, he is a feels sort of cricketer at many times. And I mean, you'd really have to watch him to know what he's all about. And I mean, he's one of my favorite cricketers to watch, right? Like if he's bowling, I'm interested whether he's bowling garbage or filth and or whether he's on a tear. But either way, he'll be remembered for a lot of things as a champion as well. But this podcast specifically is here so that, you know, somewhere down the line, maybe 10 years from now, someone comes across this on YouTube and they're like, ah, so he was the pink pill pulverizer as well. And
no, it'll be someone in 10 years time going, finally, a podcast that mentions Craig McDermott.
That as well. But anyway, you guys let us know your thoughts on Mitchell Starc, his legacy and his exploits with the pink ball in the comment section below. And that's going to be it for this episode of the Footmarks podcast. Just a quick reminder, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage, and that can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, podcasts or videos. We'll see you soon enough with another one of these episodes, but that's all for today, folks. Have a good one and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Behram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.